Alfredo Diaz is a passionate software engineer, speaker, author, and former Olympic athlete. With almost two decades of DevOps and software engineering experience under his belt, he teaches machine learning engineering. He gives lectures around the world about software development, personal development, and professional sports. Alfredo has written several books about DevOps and Python, including Python for DevOps, and his most recent book, Practical MLOps, which we're gonna be talking about today. Yeah, well, he continues to share his knowledge about resilient infrastructure, testing, and robust development practices. He gives his courses, he writes his books, he has a few presentations up his sleeve. So everyone give him a hand. Alfredo, welcome to the MLOps community meetup. There is your intro, my man. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We're happy to have you here. And I hope everyone came with questions and they've been reading his new book. In case you have not seen it, I will link to it in the chat right here because it is worth checking out. I love to start these with background information on yourself, and you have quite the story. You were not into computer programming, and somehow you've fallen into it a bit like myself, and you are now writing a book on MLOps, or have written a book on MLOps, I should say. So give us a bit of background on how you got to where you are right now.
Yeah, well, I'll skip a bunch of details so that we don't stay here for a while, but we can go as deep as you want in whatever sounds more interesting. So I didn't go to college. I had just a few months of college right out of after high school, but I was very into sports growing up as a kid. My dad was into sports as well. And he went to the Olympic Games in Mexico City in 1968. He did the high hurdles. So I was always around athletes. My mom was a swimmer, and then later a discus thrower. She had the national record for the medley in swimming with her sisters. So there was always sports around in our place. And I grew up in that environment. And at 11 years old, I told my dad, hey, this is like, I really want to do this, but not like, hey, let's do this Tuesdays and Thursdays and have the weekend off and relax. But no, like seriously, like I want to be the best there is doing this. And I was 11 years old and started training really hard. And didn't stop for 15 years. I stopped professional training when I was 26 after I came from the Olympic Games. So that I mentioned that because I think it's pretty crucial to understand that it wasn't just, oh yeah, this guy did a little bit of track, trained a little bit, did the high jump, and no, it was a big part of my life. And so I got married. Came to the U.S. I live in the U.S. have been living in the U.S. for the past 16 years or so, and was always kind of like interested in technology, but I was interested in Linux. I said, "Oh, Linux sounds pretty cool." So I'm just curious about it, started installing it in my computers, but while at the same time trying to make some income doing personal training and being involved in coaching, which is a little bit what I did in the beginning when I came to the US, and got an opportunity to work in a media agency, digital media agency, which is basically like a regular marketing agency just dedicated to digital stuff like websites and campaigns and whatnot. And they needed someone to help them out in very odd hours, which is how they could hire someone with no experience. They needed someone to work with them from 10 p.m. to, from 2 in the morning to 10 a.m. And I did that for about 5 months until they say, well, it seems like you've been doing well these early mornings. So we want to have you over and then progressively started doing a little bit more. So in that place, I met this one person who was pretty critical. And he wanted me to write some code to do basically the basic monitoring of these servers. And I had no idea. I didn't know how to write code or do anything like that. His name is Carlos Coll. He's an Argentinian, very nice person. And he said, no, I believe that you can do this. I'll teach you. I'm very busy, but I can answer some questions 15 minutes a day. I'll tell you what to read, where to go, watch some videos. Well, not videos probably, because it's
back in the day.
At that time, that's 2007, 2008. And he believed in me and taught me how to write bash scripting. Wow. And then I moved on to another company, smaller company, again, media agency. And it's like, oh, you're going to be in charge of all stuff in technology. And it's like, this is great. I want to do this. But that meant changing ink cartridges in a printer all the way to, we have some servers to rack in the data center to, hey, like the internet is not working here and there's a new employee and you need to install Microsoft Office here. So everything and anything. And that's where I met Noah Gift, who is the co-author of Practical MLOps. And it seems like it's a thing that gets repeated all over my life until now. And he said, hey, I think that you should learn Python. And I pushed back. I said, like, I don't know Noah. Like, we became friends. We both like sports. He's a huge sports fan and really healthy. And I was like, I pushed back. I said, no, why would I need Python if I know batch scripting? So, I mean, I can't believe I said that, but I was pushing really, really hard. And he said, no, this is truly a powerful thing. You should learn it. And the way he taught me was, he said, hey, find something to automate that you're doing manually at work, work on it, write some Python, and every Friday we'll just review it together and see where it goes. And I did, and I was automating stuff left and right. And he introduced me to testing, which is something I really like. Testing, we wrote a book called Testing in Python as well. So, and yeah, and so from there, he through a connection of his, I ended up working as a software engineer, because it was really hard for me to transition from being a system administrator to being a software engineer with zero backing of experience of a software engineering. And so that was very complicated. And I tried really hard for months and I couldn't get an opening and finally got one. Had to get a pay cut, less salary. But I said, you know, I think this is it. I think I'm going to do well here. And I did. And so for the past, I think over 10 years for sure, like almost, I think getting closer to 15 now, been doing a bunch of Python. And three, four years ago, Noah reached out to me. We had not kept in close contact. We had not kept in touch often or the occasional phone call, but he said, hey, I want to write this book called Python for DevOps. And how about we write it together? And I said, yeah, that sounds great. And it was a lot of hard work. But yeah, we did it. And it was with two other authors as well, Greek Georgiou and Kennedy Berman. And the book, it was a success, and it was like, I think it's still number one with a number one bestseller in Amazon, which is great. We added a bunch of stories as well there, which was something new. I don't know if it's something new, but something definitely unique. And my take on that is that if you really want to learn the ins and outs and really nitty gritty detail of things, that's fine. But if you want to have that type of reading, go read a manual, go read some documentation. This chapter is about logging. Hey, let me tell you how I was burned by logging, by bad logging, or by the lack of logging. Let me tell you a story when this thing came down, it was burning, nobody knew what was happening, and there was no logging. And this is how we fix it. And this is the lesson learned. And now that we know why this is important, now we know the context, let me go and tell you some other stuff about logging. So I think that clicked for a lot of people. There's always the occasional reviewer that doesn't quite like that type of stuff. And like, oh, I want more detail. And you're telling me nobody cares. He literally, there's a review on Amazon that's this one that says, like, I don't care about your, like, who was your boss, Alfredo? Like, who cares? We want to know the details. But we repeated the same formula for the practical MLOps book, which is what we just finished. And it took a bunch of hard work, but it's done.
Well, it's funny you say that because I definitely noticed when I was reading it, the stories, and it's easier for things to stay in your head when there's a story behind it. I don't know about everyone else who's here, but I find it infinitely easier to remember something if I can attach it to a story as opposed to just some random commands on a screen that I glance over. And your personality shines through. And I really like that, whether it's from the potatoes in Peru and the million variations of them, or it's your experience with training and getting hurt while training for the Olympics. I think you bring that special character, and those stories that are behind it really help to connect with the readers. And so I'm one of those people that likes it. I know there are people of every variation out here in the world. So yes, I can understand there are some people that don't like it. My question was, and also I know there's a few people that showed up late, so just in case you missed it, Alfredo's got a book out that we were talking about, Practical MLOps, and I just threw a link in the chat. What I wanted to ask you about the book is, it feels like this is a book geared towards people who are just starting down the journey of MLOps. Is that a safe assumption, or is it also for those experienced users? Who is this book for?
That's a very good question. And through the process of creating a book for O'Reilly, you have to go and really think about this question in particular. Like, hey, like, what do you think is your target audience? And I think is beginners to semi-experienced data scientists or people coming out of like college with a degree, and they want to get into cloud computing or doing stuff with machine learning. So I think there's a little bit of both, because some of the concepts, you know, some of the chapters I was discussing them with Noah, and they were like, well, do you think this is really useful? And he teaches a lot. He teaches in a bunch of different universities. And he said, well, you know, we need this because there's definitely a knowledge gap. Machine learning operations, this is the whole reason, or one of the primary reasons O'Reilly says, like, yeah, we need a book about MLOps, and it's because there's a knowledge gap. So going through the foundations and the core concepts that we think are important and critical, you know, some of those, if you're experienced, you might say, well, this is logical. This is sounds pretty simple. But someone that might have some sort of experience that doesn't have the DevOps or operationalizing side of things down in detail, that might be like, whoa, like that's a really interesting concept. I never thought about that. And so I think there's a little bit for both. If you are a machine learning superstar with a decade of experience doing doing machine learning and you're heavy into MLOps, maybe there's going to be things like, this sounds like too easy. The other thing that is, I think is pretty crucial is that we cover the three major clouds. Uh-huh. So you might be fine with GCP, but you had no idea about Azure. I wrote the chapter on Azure, which I really like, and I think they do incredible. And then Noah is a powerhouse with everything AWS. Yeah. So, you know, like you might be like, oh, I know everything about GCP. Well, you have Azure and AWS as well. Like, and there's really, really good stuff coming out of all of the major cloud providers with machine learning and operationalizing specifically that I think is crucial to cover.
Mm. So in the book, you talk about the hierarchy of MLOps and some of these like foundational pieces that you need or should have if you want to be practicing MLOps. Can you go into what those are and why you put those?
Yeah, well, I think that was more of Noah's doing, but I think I have an idea what he was talking about there. Coming from DevOps, from doing operations and releasing software, and going through the software release cycle and all of the different components that go into that, I think that is that brings in a lot of the missing pieces, a lot of the foundational, or I call them primary or critical or crucial pillars of MLOps, like logging, monitoring, automation. Automation has to be the basis of pretty much everything. And the thing is that when these core pieces are in place, then things are kind of like conducive to what I believe is the number one objective in machine learning, which is you need to ship that model into production. And at the end of the day, when that model gets shipped into production, you have to be able to answer the question, well, have we shipped like a better model or like not a better model according to, say, yesterday? Are we better than last week? Are we worse? Where are we worse? Where are we better? Like, where's the risk? Is there a risk? Did you forget to pin some dependency and suddenly like, your amazing model is just all broken because, you know, the deployment is just some manual script that someone's doing? So again, there's all of these pieces that you're like, oh, well, I'll have automation. I'll have a build server. I have logging. I'll have monitoring, observability. A constant feedback loop. I want to version my data sets. I want to version my models. I can safely click a button and go back and in versions. And so all of how to get there, how to get to the number one objective in machine learning operations, which is for me, which is to ship models into production in a safe, reliable, reproducible way. Well, those are the core pillars. Again, I think I mentioned a few: logging, observability, monitoring, automation. I think are critical.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you mentioned logging. I just want to give a shout out to some of the people in the community who have a quote that they wrote, and it's like, "When in doubt, log it out." And I think you probably would appreciate that one after hearing the story of how you got burnt by logging. Do you want to share that story real fast before we go forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So this happened, this is part of the Python for DevOps book, but what happened was I was working in a big company. We were like 40 or 50 engineers or something like that. And we're building this very large CMS. And so every day at about 5:30 in the morning, the database would have like increased load of, just increased load, and we'd become very slow. And then they called me to be part of the performance team. And it's like, oh, Alfredo, you're going to be part of a performance team. We're going to do performance stuff and make everything super fast. And it's like, okay, this is great. Well, your first task is that this thing has been progressively becoming slower and slower and slower for the past 8 months. We know this is a thing roughly at 5:30 in the morning. And we know that roughly, like, it's taking longer and longer, this spike in load and CPU, memory usage, everything, like the server just really goes down, like almost goes down because it has so much load. You need to fix this. And my first question was like, well, don't we have like a DBA that needs to like look at that thing? It's, if it's the database server, it's like, well, no, the DBAs don't know what's going on. So you're going to go in and fix it. And it's like, okay. So I go in and I say, all right, so my first question is like, let me see some logs and see what the queries are. And like, no logs. And it's like, what do you mean no logs? No, we cannot turn on logging because this server is it's a very busy server. And we've turned logging, it's just so much output that it would fill out the devices and it would run out of space in like minutes. And the I/O produced would be like through the roof. So we can't turn logging. And I thought it was incredible. I really thought it was incredible to have three DBAs that were explaining to me why it was reasonable to not have logging, number one, not know exactly what was going on at 5:30 in the morning, and be in a position where, like, well, not only we don't know, we don't have anything that might tell us the answer. So I kind of like bargained with them and it's like, okay, like I'll compromise. Can you enable logging for like 10 minutes at 5:30 in the morning so I can see something? And so they did. And there was this one query, which was, it showed up and it's like the most expensive. Like PostgreSQL has this way where like you can explain what's going on. And it was a select star from all the tables. And I was like, who is writing this code that is doing this? And I, you know, eventually what it was not a developer that went in and was doing bad stuff. Someone had written a backup script and it was running with the cron tab. So it was on a schedule at around 5:30 in the morning to back up all of the database at that time. And that was why there was a lot of load because it was selecting all of the tables and all the rows and everything and anything and copying it over to somewhere else. And I thought it was just ridiculous. I think it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen running this bash script that was running backups. And not good, you know?
So I have
my opinion, not good. Not a good way to run production databases.
I think I know what my next song for you is going to be called. It's going to be, it's 5:30 a.m. Do you know where your logs are? But how did you fix that problem? What did you do in the end? Did you just get rid of that bash script?
So I have the answer. I know how to fix it. Okay, Alfredo, so let us know how you're going to fix it. Well, we're not going to run the script. This is just nonsense. This is just plain silly. And the DBAs were like really against it. And it's like, well, this is how we do web backups. And I'm like, you don't need backups. And they were like, whoa, what do you mean we don't need backups? So yeah, you don't need backups. But no, we need a backup. This is a business requirement. And I pushed back and I said, you already have backups. And you don't know that you have backups? No. What is going on? Well, you have a primary database, which you are running the backups from. And you have like four replicas. That's your backup. It's already backed up. Why do you need a script that copies everything again? What are we even doing this? Like, they commented out the cron tab entry, no longer running this script at 5:30 in the morning, problem solved.
There you go. That's a great learning and always fun that you get to share it with others because we get to learn also. And so there is the importance of logs in a short little story. So I wanted to ask you about the papers that come out from Microsoft and Google about maturity and how to look at the maturity levels of a company when it comes to ML and their MLOps systems. And they focus a lot on automation. And I know that you're really big into automation. And I also have heard from others that automation is not everything when it comes to ML, and especially when it comes to putting machine learning into production, especially not at the beginning, or especially if you're not trying to do something at a Google scale. And so I'm wondering about that and how you feel about these papers and the automation piece.
That's a big contention point. I mean, you could. I've been in environments where they're like, "Well, it's proof of concept. We're doing proof of concept POC. Sorry, we're just still trying it out." I'm like, you're trying. It's very early. It's very early in the process. We don't need all of these things. And it's like, well, I mean, even if you're doing, I mean, to me, proof of concept is just like, you just want to have like one answer, one prediction, seeing like if that roughly gets it, and then that's it. Like you can't be testing it out for like months. And you know, that's like, where it's a fine line. You have to decide like, well, what are we doing? Well, at a point where you have to repeat the process of like creating your proof of concepts, like, well, now we have different data. Like, let's see if that data, wait a second. Like, now you have different data. Now you were not satisfied with what you had before in your data set, and now you're changing to see if your proof of concept works. You need to build a pipeline. What are you doing that you don't have? Well, proof of concept, like, no, I think that's just, you know, you're slapping a sticker onto the product as a proof of concept, so we get a free pass. I think that's not good. I think you can definitely start automation early. How soon? Well, it depends on how comfortable and how experienced the engineers are and the people that you're working with. I haven't catched the contents of the papers that you're mentioning, but I do know about the pushback on automation, and if it's too late in the process or if it's too early in the process. Well, first of all, if it's too late in it, like if it's already like we already have all of these things, there's always things to automate. There's always things to automate. Like you cannot, even when you've automated everything, you can say, well, let's take a look at this. What else can we automate? I'll give you one example, not specifically to machine learning, but very applicable. And we had a thing where we had these microservices that were spinning up. Kind of like an elastic service of bringing up build nodes that would go into the build server and register themselves. And so they were capturing a bunch of data. And I said, well, every now and then when these things are failing and when they're not in a good state, I have to go, someone has to, or me perhaps, someone has to go in, say, add more storage or change the devices or add another partition or whatever it is to solve the problem. And then they need to bounce the server, change some configuration file, and make that node register back itself to the build server so it makes it available. I was like, hey, yeah, I'm good and whatnot. And I said, this is horrible. This is like, I don't want to be doing this. This is silly. And so what we came up with is like, we would have, and of course, this is pre-Kubernetes. So bear with me if you're like, oh, well, you invented Kubernetes, but no, this was before. And so we exposed in the API like the healthiness of the service, and if the health was not okay, it would bring a 500 with an explanation. It's like, yeah, I'm not healthy, but you know, I'm getting this problem. I can't connect to the database, or my hard drive is full, or whatever, And so all you needed to do was, instead of re-registering and doing all of these things, all you needed to do was, if you fix the problem, just bounce the server or kill it, and another one will spin up and pick up all of the new changes and re-register itself into the pool. And before re-registering, it would say, hey, are you healthy? Yes, I'm healthy. Okay, perfect. But there was already automation in place. This was part of a big build server. I think there's always stuff to improve and stuff to like say, well, like this, the notion of self-healing is very appealing. Like, in storage systems specifically, when you start having fragmentation in storage and you start having like, we have a server that would, like in distributed storage systems, that's key. If you have a server going up in flames, which you will at some point, if you have 100 servers, one will go down. You want something that, you don't need someone afraid of to go in and the rack and figure out where the drive is and shuffle stuff around. No, that should happen automatically. And so, and then early in the stage of machine learning, I think pipelines, some sort of automation. You don't need to build a universe of stuff for pipelines to be useful. You know, you can have some sort of automation in place that will help you get even the proof of concepts of faster feedback loops and iterations and evaluation. At the end of the day, what you want with a proof of concept, even with a proof of concept, is like, is this good enough? Do we need to tweak something? Do we need to change something in the data set? So if you have something already that is like a pipeline or a pipeline, and you're making some changes and you're getting that feedback loop answering some of your questions, even for proof of concept, I think it's great. I like, why not? And then you can grow from there.
So I know you talked about testing and tests, and you learning tests was a door opener for yourself. Can you talk about testing in MLOps and how you go about doing that?
Yeah, well, the testing universe is large and vast. And one of the things about testing is when I started learning Python, I had no idea what testing was. And Noah came in one day, and Noah Giff, the co-author of Practical MLOps, he said, you should learn about testing. And it's like, what do you mean? And he said, well, there's unit testing and this thing and that thing. So not only that, but he says, like, you should learn, you should subscribe to this testing in Python mailing list. It's full of like knowledgeable people. They'll help you out with your questions. And I got interested into it. He told me one thing that I was like, I think is true. And I've kind of like tried to like think about that when I'm interviewing candidates that want to work with me or my team. And that is, hey, you don't want to get to an interview and someone to get to ask you if you know testing or what testing is about, and you have no idea, because they'll laugh at you. Professional software engineers do testing. So you should really learn these as your next step in your journey to learning Python. And I did, and I think it's great. Now, just like logging, it can be very complicated. Logging metrics can be like complicated. It's a combination of complicated with boring. It can be. And
deadly,
so I think
combination.
So a lot of people are like, that doesn't sound like nice. So the same thing happens to testing. And for whatever reason, documentation has the same problem as well. It's like people are like, whoa, no, I don't, English, very hard. No, don't want to do. It's like, no, that's not me. I'm known for very well documented projects and lots of tests and lots of good logging or whatever possible good logging that answers questions. But you were asking me a question about, and I think I lost track there a little bit. You asked me about testing in machine learning, right? So
yeah,
in the book we have a couple of examples, and you know, you can apply testing to different stages and different types of testing that you want to do. So in the observability portion or the monitoring portion. Monitoring is kind of like sort of testing, but it's kind of like it could be a stage in your pipeline where you're making sure that drift is acceptable. Say, for example, you say, well, my drift is, I don't know, whatever percentage, am I beyond that threshold? And it's like, yes. Oh, okay. So red alarm, don't ship to production. This thing is not good. So that's sort of testing, but now, there's all kinds of other things that you can do, and it can be as simple and basic as you want to like more complex scenarios. I did give like a short example of hey, you didn't pin your dependencies, and suddenly like your super duper awesome machine learning model that is in production is spitting out tracebacks and 500s, and nobody understands what's going on. And you'd be like, I don't know what's going on. Well, you don't want that to happen. And testing can be involved, and it can be anything and everything, really. Like in that particular case, what you can do is, as part of building, packaging your machine learning model into a container, well, you have a series of verification steps. It doesn't need to be Python per se. I mean, if you don't like Python, or you don't know how to use the unit testing library for Python, or PyTest, which is the library that I like for testing in Python, you can do anything, really. Like you can, as part of the build step, like you package the container and then you make some verification. Can I get a request? Can I get a prediction? Yes, I can get a prediction. Oh, was it a 200? If it's over HTTP, did I get a 200? Yes, you got a 200. Oh, okay, great. Was the data shape? And this one's critical. And I put it in the book. I give an example of like sending a request, and this thing was not quite working. And what happened was that one of the keys in the JSON response changed. And so instead of like being something like something underscore something, it was no longer an underscore. It was like a dash, and it was a string. And I was like, can you catch that? And it has happened to me hundreds of times. Can you verify that the responses that you're giving are what you expect? Does any of the keys that you're like, if you're saying, I have an example of sentiment analysis. You can say if the JSON response is sentiment colon true or false. How many times, I can't tell you how many times I've been burned by like seeing a true that is a string instead of like a really, really a Boolean. And like, how did this happen? So somewhere along the process, this thing turned into a string, and why is it not a Boolean anymore? Like, who knows? But it's really difficult to catch if you're seeing the and suddenly you broke the universe, because if that thing is in production and all of your clients are expecting a Boolean, and now you're suddenly sending a string, oh my goodness, everything just like Python evaluates to a string that has a value in it that's true. So you're in big trouble. Like you're not doing well. So testing definitely helps there. And you can catch all of those things way, way, way before shipping stuff into production, which is also a thing that I'm very passionate about. Like catch things as early as possible. Do like anything that comes at the tail end of the process, the longer it takes, or the closer you are to production, the more expensive it is to like, and expensive can be like dollar amount in engineering time, or it can be dollar amount in services that you're using to produce this, and dollar amount to how long it's going to take me to ship another version of this thing that fixes the problem.
Wise words right there. So if I understand correctly, you can never test too much.
No. More verification, more tests. I mean, why not? Like, there's even an example of using vulnerability scanning. I know that vulnerability scanning is going to sound like pretty like odd, like machine learning, vulnerability scanning. Well, guess how we're packaging machine learning models? We're putting them in containers, and those containers have what? They have a bunch of libraries. And you can say, well, I only have this Flask application and two endpoints, and I have just like 20 lines of Python. That's great. But that thing comes shipping Python 3.8, or let's assume that it's Python 3.6 that has some vulnerability problems. And like suddenly like you're like, whoa, like I had no idea about that. Or it can come with a bunch of system binaries and packages that came with a container to support Python or whatever else. And you're like, whoa, I didn't. And so why not? Why not scan your containers before they hit the production and catch anything that has a critical vulnerability announced? And you're like, well, I guess I should not get this container into production. And I should like really take a look at what's going on. And perhaps it's fine. Perhaps it's a vulnerability in some C library that nobody uses, and it could never be related to the stuff that you're doing with your machine learning model. But again, that's a thing. That's a verification step. That's some sort of testing. And I think that's good to have. There's always stuff that you can test and verify before getting into production.
So you can never test enough. You can never automate enough. There are a few things that you feel very strongly about, and I like it. I want to get into the chapter in the book about interoperability, because I think that is something that is coming up. And yeah, there's a lot of people that are trying to tackle this. And I really like how you put it. You have, maybe you're developing in AWS and they have their certain way of doing things. And then you want to go and bring that model to Azure. Or I think you did it vice versa. It was like you're developing in Azure and you're using AutoML, and you couldn't do anything with that AutoML model when you went and you brought it to AWS. Can you talk about the pains with this interoperability and why we need to create some kind of standards?
Yeah. So let's see. So you definitely can get into particular situations, particular problems like I did, and I explained the book where I was playing with AutoML in Azure and creating this model. And it's like 2 months later, I was like, oh, okay, so time for me to take it and put it somewhere else. And I could not figure out what some of the versions were to recreate the model, so that I needed to like go in and get into to the details of the model itself. And so I had to find out, like, I don't know what version Azure used to like create these models. So I had to kind of like do a trial and error. And someone mentioned like, hey, like, Azure always uses the latest version of this client library because you need to use the Azure machine learning extension. And I was like, well, what version? It's like, you don't know. What log has that? It's like, who knows? That you have like 100 million entries in this log file. Who knows which one was that? It's like, so you're in trouble there. But interoperability fixes a bunch of problems. I think and this is one thing that we haven't really touched on, which is a part of my core beliefs, and especially because of my background of not coming from with a computer science degree or no specialization in data engineering or in algorithms, or I'm not, you know, have not no analytics or math background either. And that is, it is critical that we make it easier. What can we do as a machine learning community that we can make it easier and democratize the use of machine learning? How about we no longer point fingers and stigmatize people who say, well, ooh, you don't know calculus. Ooh, so you're not very good. You're sorry. You probably can't do machine learning. I think that's a fallacy. And we're living in a day where the more people doing machine learning, and I know I'm kind of like drifting a little bit with my answer, but bear with me for a second. I know that the more people doing machine learning today, the better we're off. If someone knows Python and that was his first and only language, or is doing JavaScript or some other interpreted language, You cannot require learning assembly as a prerequisite. You cannot say, well, you need to need binary programming. You don't know assembly. You don't know Pascal. You don't know Turbo Pascal. Oh, I'm sorry. You cannot write JavaScript. Like what? Like, but like it, as much as that sounds ridiculous, I mean, sure. Like learn some assembly if you want to. You want to learn some compilers? I think that's useful. But it's not a requirement, and you can be very productive, very powerful doing all of this stuff if you're not dealing with all of the other things. And so to me, that's crucial. And interoperability goes a little bit into that, where it is making it easier. It's making it easier. It's like, it doesn't matter where you produce this model. Like, and there's a lot of transformers as well. You can grab one thing that was produced somewhere else and transform it into Onyx, which is the open, the Open Neural Network Exchange, I think it stands for that. So Onyx is this kind of like a standard for what it's an open standard of what a model, would be that can operate in different places. And I think it was started by Microsoft and Facebook, if I'm not mistaken. So I think that goes right into it. And why is it important? Well, I can grab that and put it in an edge device and deploy it, and it doesn't matter. I don't need to worry about the details. Now I can worry about the model itself. Now I can worry in the container itself or the packaging or the code that is going to talk to that. I don't need to worry about the support that needs to be present in my edge device so that I can do predictions in the high plains of Peru where there's no internet connection. And now I'm being useful, and that I think that's priceless. I think that's tremendous. Like being able to like, hey, you like a framework, and you want to change frameworks? No, that there's no walls around here. Like you can change that and go into Onyx, and off you go. Not a problem.
Well, you talk about something that I found fascinating, and you mentioned that you give this to candidates that are wanting to work for you, or whenever you interview someone, you say, you have two options. It can be simple and opinionated or flexible and complex. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So that's such a good question because, man, it's I have a bunch of stories about that because everybody wants very simple and super flexible. It's like, we want this in like almost no lines of code or whatever is the thing that you're building. And I want like 20 different configuration settings that can make it super easy. And it's like, well, that it doesn't work that way. It's like, it just does not work that way. You have to strike a balance. It's true, but you have to stay true to your principles. Like, what is it that you're trying to solve here? I think that the self-analysis, like asking yourself these questions about, well, wait a second, what is it that I'm trying to do here? Like, am I trying to make this? I mean, if you want to make something super flexible, you have to be prepared to deal with all of the extra things all of the extra side effects that will cause, that will generate. I'll give one example. I work with a group of very talented and smart people building distributed storage systems. And every other release, which was like every 4 or 6 months, we would see more configuration options for the software. I was like, well, so why are we adding more configuration options? And the answer was, well, we want to make it more flexible. But by making it more flexible, it was immensely complex. So if you have two configuration options, then to test if these configurations options are working as expected, then you're going to have three tests or four tests rather. You're going to have four tests. You're going to have, you know, it's a matrix. You're building a matrix. But the software that I was working with had over 100 configuration flags. Like, I'm not going to be able to test that like that. So we're like, you know, grab, like, I don't want to see these. I know it's going to, we haven't really tested these. Like, what happens when we turn that flag on and this flag is off? I don't know. I think it should work. I think so too. Let's keep the faith up and hope that this thing works, but it's untestable. And so to me, that is pretty important. You have to decide right from the get-go. Like, I was at some point, I was working with this command line tool that had to do certain operations in the system, and they said, well, we want it to be super simple. And I'm like, okay, so if you want to make it simple, if you want the tool to make a bunch of decisions for you, then it's not going to be very flexible. And I think we see a little bit of that in AutoML. It's like, oh, you want AutoML? Okay, yeah, sure. AutoML is going to take a bunch of decisions for you. It's making it really simple. But you cannot say, well, this is AutoML, but you have all of these 700 things that you can twist and change and move. Like, It doesn't work that way. So but I think it's hard for people to realize midpoint, which happened in this one tool that I was working on, where it was like, oh yeah, I know that it's opinionated and it's pretty good, but now we want to support these other things. And we want to have a bunch of different options and configurations. Like, well, this is going to be pretty complicated. And that shifting paradigm for creating software and building applications, I think it's just pretty important to be aware of.
Yeah, I love these stories that you're throwing at us, and I thank you for that. I want to just make sure that everyone that is with us right now knows you can jump in and ask any question you want, throw it in the chat as time is winding down. I have another question for you. In the meantime, if anyone wants to jump in, I'll ask this one before someone types away at their question. You mentioned about abstraction layers, and this goes along with that, like simple and opinionated or flexible and complex, and how adding another abstraction layer rarely makes things much better. Can you talk about that a little bit more in depth?
Yeah, absolutely. So my go-to example for these is OpenStack. I have a bunch of friends, and by the way, like I'm not trashing OpenStack. I think OpenStack is a wonderful. It's actually the biggest Python project in the planet. It has, I think, over a million lines of Python code. It's like it's tremendous. It's a very difficult project to manage, and there's many dependencies, many different things that you can plug into it, and it's basically to manage virtualization. As if you were like your own cloud provider. And it turns out that it's a massive project. A lot of like different components that are optional. You can say, I want OpenStack, but with that thing, but not with this thing and this other thing, or a combination thereof of these things. I don't want the metric service. Yeah, I want the metric service, but I want to deploy it somewhere else, not in this server, but in this big old server, or like how much RAM do I need? I don't have space here. How do you install all these things? This distributed cloud environment and make it simple. Well, it turns out that's very, very hard to do. And so my example is a thing that was called Triple O. And Triple O came from OpenStack on OpenStack. So what would happen is that this installer would create like a mini OpenStack installation that knew very well how to deal with services and storage devices and servers and networks. And because it was like minimal, then it would be able to install OpenStack on those. And then the ephemeral OpenStack installation would go away. And then the good one would stay up. It turns out that was also pretty complicated. And someone had a group of people thought, well, this is getting really complicated and we're not getting where we want. So they created Quintuplo, which was OpenStack on OpenStack on OpenStack. And I don't think the project took off, but they put development effort into it. And I don't think that's the right way to do it. And again, we go back to, well, the abstraction layers comes because we want more flexibility, we want more configuration options, want more knobs. Well, that there's a cost. There's a cost associated with it, and slapping another abstraction layer on it, it's very quickly going to expose again the problem of like this is very complicated, and it's because it's very flexible. How about we remove all of these hundreds of options here, and just like, you know, cover our eyes and then just deploy, because then it's going to be easy. Then let's not give an option of like 20 different network providers or 20 ways of configuring devices. How about we choose like two? Either you are using an SSD or a spinning drive, and off we go. That's it. No, we need, there's some clients that may want to have some partitions, or they want to use a slice of a spinning drive with an NVMe. It's like, no, let's not do that. And let's just like, you know, it's us, it's our product. We can tell them like, this is the best way to use it. less options.
Yeah, I think that the, what is it, quadruple O, or what was it? It seems quintuple like it's a meme. O. Yeah, it seems like that is something out of science fiction. And it only, you know, truth is stranger than fiction sometimes. So last question for you. I'm wondering about your stance on, because I've talked to Noah, we've had him on here before, and then I've also talked to Joe Race, who is a good friend of Noah's. I think you know him. Yep. Also.
Yep.
And Noah really advocates for using the cloud native tools, or I should say like the tools from the cloud providers. So if you're on AWS, just pick up SageMaker and go with that, because it's going to be your safest surefire bet of getting something out there, and you're not going to have these problems of you learn some obscure tool or you adopt an obscure tool, and then later on either that startup goes out of business, or maybe it's a language that you've adopted or a framework, and then nobody knows how to actually program in that language or framework because it's too niche and it falls out of fashion. And I was talking to Joe about this, and he said, yeah, well, you do also have to look at, if you're talking about AWS or GCP or Azure, there's a lot of skunkwork projects that come out of those big cloud providers that end up going out of business. And nobody says anything about that. So you have just as much risk of that happening with a cloud provider as you do with a startup. Granted, it's not as probable when you think about it. You think, no, I have security because this is a cloud provider. But we can all look at like Google Glass and what happened to that little project. It's in a whole different realm, but that died, right? And there's plenty of projects that die every day within these big cloud providers. So I'm wondering what your take on this is. Do you take the risk and start going with the smaller providers that are startups in the MLOps tooling space, or do you just stay safe and go with SageMaker or Azure ML?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question. You're going to have risk anywhere you are. You're going to have risk when you hire a machine learning engineer. You're going to have risk with a data scientist. You're going to have risk with a software engineer. I've worked with people and it's like, yeah, I thought this person, when I interviewed this person, was like really excellent. They're now not to be really excellent. Like, why would I do that? If I'm a startup, if I'm the owner of the company and I'm hiring a software engineer and it turns out not to be good, that's a problem. Like it's a three-person startup, and suddenly like 30% of the company, not good. What do we do then? So the answer is not like, well, you can't hire software engineers. You have to mitigate risk and, you know, find a Peruvian that wants to work with you. Suddenly I come and say, yeah, I can do the work. So I think making calculated risks and the return on investment that you will get from cloud providers is orders of magnitude higher than just going from tooling that, you know, even if it's not very new, but it has not made it into cloud native stuff, that is not that reliable. My opinion, I think I'll have to agree more with Noah, without saying that what Joe says is wrong. Yeah, sure. You'll have certain situations where a cloud provider or cloud providers say, well, this is not, yeah, like I'm going to make some very non-plausible prediction, but let's assume that tomorrow Onyx says, like Microsoft and Facebook says, like, yeah, it turns out this was horrible. And you have this potato farmer in the high plains of Peru deploying to his edge devices a bunch of Onyx models. What is this person going to do? Well, tough luck. I mean, what are we going to do? The probability that will happen, you know, I would say pretty minimal. If if not something newer and better will come to replace it and make your life easier. But if I'm going for reliability, speed, and using products that have been very well thought through with, I'm pretty sure that I know a bunch of people that work with at Amazon and at Google and at Azure that are very, very smart. And I'm just taking advantage of that. And I think that's priceless. If I'm a small startup and I want to use the best, well, I'm just going to go cloud native.
Amazing. So it looks like that's all the time we got. I could sit here chatting with you for another few hours, but I want to be respectful of your time and everyone who is with us still for joining. Thank you. And really appreciate the knowledge that you have imparted on us. This has been awesome. Everyone who is not in our Slack, please join us in Slack. If you are not there already, I'll throw a link to that in the chat right now. And also get Alfredo and Noah's new book, or just get the free trial to, this is bad that I say this, get the free trial to O'Reilly. No,
I don't think it's bad. Yeah. O'Reilly has a free trial. Like, you can try it out for 30 days and see if you like it and read the book. And if you think the book is not good, well, nothing bad happened. Nobody died.
There you go.
I'm awesome, not going to get Alfredo. Upset. Thank you so much, Demetrios. Like, really, really liked everything here. Happy to be here. Happy to talk about MLOps and all of the other stuff. I think it's pretty useful.
Awesome. Well, take care.